Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
So, very, very enjoyable chat with Lovan. He's a real charming gentleman, isn't
Fascinating. Fascinating. And I mean, another huge ranging gambit of conversation. That's what all these podcasts are like. It's fascinating. You sort of think it might be down this path. And I think what we've learned now is a lot of guests, you just sort of start talking and then woof.
The start of you know, people will be blown away by his, it wasn't even the start of his life. It was when he was still waiting to be born and the hardship the family went through. But also just looking at the creative side of his life and how that's influenced his professional career in dentistry.
But and how he's been able to do both. You know, that, I think that's the other thing, is that a lot of people, you know, they can still follow their passions. It's just sometimes their passions have to be different than what they do. Mm. You know, you might want to be a classical guitarist or whatever it is, but the chances of you ever making a career out of it
is slim.
So make a career of something else that you're good at and enjoy and then do that other bit.
But also that trip to Sri Lanka, and how that sparked the idea for Chairside. I think I'm always fascinated as to what was it that got something going. I think people take a huge amount from that.
No, what was the nugget? Yeah, it's brilliant. Really good again.
So here we are again, another rich episode coming our way.
Indeedy. Looking forward to this one too.
Absolutely. So today we are delighted, very privileged. We've got Lovan Gunners-Wareham joining us. Lovan is a dentist, also a co-principal of a practice. He's the founder of Chairside and also a rapper. The spoken word.
Look at that. That is impressive.
Very interesting. We've got a lot to get through today, Lovan. How are you doing?
Welcome. Wide-ranging set of skills.
It's a real pleasure to be on the podcast today, guys. I've been looking forward to this. Been listening to you guys for a while, and it's a really interesting pinch me moment actually, because I never imagined myself coming onto a podcast like this. So exciting to be here.
We're grateful for your time. Just by virtue of the introduction, you're not short of things to keep you busy. So we're grateful for you finding the time for us. Before we get to your wide and varied dental career, let's kind of wind it back. What things do we need to know about you from your childhood that kind of explain the guy you are today? What was your childhood like?
Interesting. I was born in Sri Lanka. My parents are Sri Lankan. In a difficult time in Sri Lanka, actually, there was it was sort of like the peak of the civil war there, which I believe led my parents largely to reconsider their future there, along with a lot of their family, along with a lot of relatives, along with the community in the northeast part of Sri Lanka.
So I was going to say, was there quite a strong Sri Lankan community?
Yeah, I was going to say, was it a big sort of family move as such?
There was. Interestingly, my father and mother moved because dad actually got he got a placement at Stirling University to pursue aquaculture, because there was a huge prawn farming industry in Sri Lanka and he was really interested in that. And so he ended up doing a PhD at Stirling Uni. And so I grew up at Stirling University on campus, raving with the freshers from the age of 1 to 5.
Somehow the Fresh Prince of Stirling doesn't quite ring the same true, does it, as Bel-Air?
The Fresh Prince of Stirling, I like that. I wasn't exposed to the community then, but when we moved to London after that, there was a very large Tamil community of individuals who'd been through some traumatic things, right? Their parents largely. I was really lucky. I didn't see any of that. I was exposed to it through stories, but I'm very fortunate. I was too young to understand it at the time. I grew up surrounded by extremely grateful people for being able to make it out of a difficult situation. I grew up in an environment where, you know, not many people came to this country with much in their pockets. And so they had to create and build. And so the people around me were incredibly inspiring, because now 20, 30 years on, well, actually more than that, 35 years on, you see, I grew up around people growing businesses because they didn't have opportunities. They didn't have education. So they had to build a life for them and their families. A lot of these people had come with young families, right? So they get thrown into the deep end. So there was this entrepreneurial spirit that existed within our community. And not only that, but our community is very much quite creative as a group. Like we have a massive cinema scene called Collywood. And amongst that, we've got spin-off dancers, spin-off singers. It's almost like we even have this thing called an arangetrum, where if you learn an instrument up to a very high, the highest degree, you get celebrated by putting on a show, and the whole community would come and watch. Right. And this was in line with a big, strong focus on education. So my path to dentistry largely led by the virtue that, and you may understand that from the British dental community as well, was that there was a strong focus on education. Mm-hmm. Because I would probably say a lot of our parents didn't have the opportunity to study. And
what did dad do, Lovin?
Sorry?
When he came down to London, what job did your dad do?
So he despite having his sort of like PhD in aquaculture, there was nothing to do with aquaculture in London. So he ended up picking up jobs here and there to start with, because obviously when you come here with nothing and you're here in a I would probably say a refugee status, a lot of us anyway, he worked from the bottom up. So he was like petrol stations, working night shifts. Mum would so when my little brother was born, when I was five, all the way through her pregnancy, she was working at Tesco. Trying to set up a life.
What I love Lovin about it is that everybody assumes that life's linear and life just goes on an upward trajectory, and it always just keeps moving the same direction. Mm-hmm. And I find it remarkable that you have somebody who's got a PhD in aquaculture.
I was gonna say, it's a bloke who comes to
London, really? And is prepared to rebase himself and do whatever he needs to rebuild, and that's all for the greater good of his future family. You know, the future of his family is the most important thing. So there's no, there's nothing on him that says, "But I have a PhD in aquaculture and I need to use that." I don't care. I'm prepared to reset my life to make sure that my family have a better future.
But also from the flip side, isn't it, that there was no one who said, "Hey, you've got a PhD in agriculture, so we'll be able to, we can use that knowledge."
Yeah.
And not necessarily of aquaculture, but the fact you've actually got a PhD.
But going back to the thing you said about culture and resilience, what great lessons for you to learn as a young man from your parents, which kind of gives us a great insight as to why you've gone on to have the success you've had in your career.
What's that phrase? Character building.
Yeah,
isn't
those
it?
Things were instilled in you very young.
Well, I don't think I appreciated that then, but I it definitely became a mindset that was ingrained. I owe my parents everything with the view that they went through a lot and they came out trying to build a better life for us through difficult times, but along that journey also taking risks that we could learn from, and realizing that one thing I really loved about the aquaculture and the PhD thing, to going to start off when you had a couple of hundred in your pocket and you land in London, to picking up any job, is the fact that you remove ego from the entire thing. And when you remove ego, you almost become free, I feel. And, that's something I've been trying to work on over many, many years, is almost be very real, grounded and free from ego. Because when you start building organizations, you realize that to inspire and to try and lead people, a group of people as a team towards a common goal or a common mission, ego can really get in the way, can't it?
But modern society doesn't help, does it?
No.
Modern society feeds
a hierarchy.
I was going to say, Andy, society, it celebrates ego.
This is my challenge. As much as behind the scenes, I'm fighting or working on myself to try and eliminate that and realize that we came with nothing and I leave with nothing. And like fundamentally, we're on a journey. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist or it doesn't matter if you work here or there or whatever. We're all humans and that's just a journey. Or we're a product of our experiences. We're a product of our environment. We're just products of what we've been exposed to. I know incredibly intelligent people who've just never been exposed to the entrepreneurial journey. They've just never been exposed to it, right? Mm. But I know they could smash it in anything they do. They just don't know. And you can't know everything either. But what you've been exposed to allows you to do that. And what my biggest issue is with things like social media is such that as much as I try and battle the ego situation, I find that especially doing things in the creative space and trying to grow your following or trying to do all this, it's a very egocentric thing, right? And positioning yourself is very much an egocentric thing. Unless you're in a position where you're able to showcase your true face and true feelings and not care about numbers and all of that and show vulnerability. And that's just you being real. But then you also get, unfortunately, valued or viewed based on your metrics when you're in that space. So I've always said, like, I'm not in it to chase the numbers or the followers or thingy, but at the same time, I could be out and people be like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And they'll see, you know, you see your profile and be like, oh, you'd make music or whatever, right? And you're like, oh, but you haven't got like hundreds of thousands of followers, so you're probably not that great, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, like,
I just need that validation.
That's not the game I'm trying to play here, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't need the validation of all those numbers. It's just like,
I think
you've got to be comfortable in yourself.
But also, I think the whole destructive thing with numbers generally, whether it's money, followers, likes, you know, listens, whatever it is the bigger the number, there's an assumption that you're doing better. You know, if somebody has more money than somebody else, we assume that they're doing really well because they've got more money. But that's such a simple and in some ways, you know, useless way of measuring success.
Yeah,
but definitely. Because numbers go up and we know how to look at numbers, it's an easy way and a lazy way to do it.
Mm.
But what is success? What is the definition of success?
Yeah.
That's something that I have been thinking about for so long. That
and it varies from person to person, doesn't it? I mean, we do a course where we sort of say part of it is we say, what is your definition of success? You know, and it might be you want loads of money. It might be you want loads of car. You might want to play more golf. You might want to read books. You might want to drink yourself stupid. You might want to spend more time with your kids. You know, it's different for people, and they have to find it themselves rather than get it defined by someone else.
And also the other one is, what's the measurement scale for happiness? You know,
yeah.
It's, you know, and like you say, it all kind of ties together. And then, like you said, you then got this external world watching everything that you do as well. So you're trying to be as authentic as possible, but you're also aware that, you know, in particular with social media platforms, they are a marketing tool.
Yeah.
It's a way of being seen. So you have to kind of play that. So it's not.
I think my 130 followers probably. follow my marketing.
But the thing is, if they're 130 of the right people,
it's all about quality. I'm pretty sure.
When we started doing this, you know, we said before we started recording, we're very grateful to Payman, who has his own podcast, and he said that stuck with us. He said, when I record, I'm just looking to have a really good conversation with that person.
Mm.
If somebody else listens to it after it's released and they take value from it, then that's great. But the value should be the moment we're having now. We're chatting for some time. We're finding out stuff. It's really interesting. Yeah. If a byproduct of that is other people also
actually
enjoy
find it interesting,
then that's great. And if only 10 people listen to it, but they all took something really valuable from it, that's more important than it potentially being blitzed out to thousands. Mm.
Exactly. And there's so much value in that. But we're surrounded by... we get mistaken sometimes between quality because of the vanity metrics around it, right? The vanity metrics doesn't necessarily mean something's a high quality, and that's been marketing throughout the test of time. That's been over history, right? Sometimes the best products aren't the ones that are most popular. That's just great marketing, but that itself is a science and an art and a skill. So
Absolutely.
And your comment there about science, art and skill is a nice segue into dentistry, because you told us that you went into dentistry for the love of science and the craft, but the thing that you really fell in love with was that directly teaching and working on an individual patient and educating and treating that patient. Mm-hmm. What was it about that kind of minutiae of it that really drew you in? Because it is a very artistic world, but what was it about treating that one patient?
I think when you start, first of all, I had a clear vision early doors in my life of what I wanted from, what made me happy and what kind of purpose I'd like to pursue. I think I had a very clear, I think I was quite lucky early doors through the experiences that I knew that anything was somewhat possible.
When did you want to become a dentist? Did that sort of, that following on? How's that sort of bit?
Yeah. So the reason why why dentistry came out was because I also feel like if you're in the pursuit of something meaningful, you have to impact one person at a time to start, right? And what better feeling than to be what I call in the trenches, helping people firsthand with the ability where you only a few of us have a skill set that's able to solve that problem for them, mm-hmm. right? I think that's pretty incredible. So learning how to develop that skill and then combining that skill with empathy towards people, with communication, with compassion, and then continuously evolving that skill through evidence-based learning, and then delivering that day in, day out to people who need your help is a privilege. It really is a privilege. And you don't get much more satisfaction than that, really. Like, you know, it could be any person from any walk of life, someone who is possibly coming from a difficult background, right? Or somebody who is someone who's elderly and is lonely, right? And you have real meaningful conversations with people I would never have the opportunity to speak with on the street. If you think about it, the number of conversations I've had seeing 20 patients, 25 patients a day for the past 12 years, right? 5 days a week up until maybe the last 4 years has opened my mind to the world more than anything else I could have ever done. And I'm not talking about fleeting conversations. I'm talking about speaking with parents, grandparents who become, parents who become grandparents, and then 3 years later, sadly realizing one of them develops dementia. Then 2 years after that, realizing that they get put into a care home. And now I'm speaking to the wife. I've been fortunate that I've been at the practice for 12 years since my foundational training. So I've followed people on their journey.
Mm. Did you do your training at the practice?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Interesting.
So I did my training there 12 years ago and I stayed on as an associate. Then I became a partner. Mm. And I've followed my patient base through their journey, through their life.
It's interesting about that sort of, I've never really thought about it that in a way. You're mixing and you're conversing with people of varying, you know, ages, social skills, social sets, communicate. Yeah. It's fascinating. I hadn't really sort of thought about it in a way that we know you talk to patients, but hearing you say, you know, you could be talking to someone who's, I don't know, at one end of the scale, and then you've got another guy who's might be a multimillionaire or something.
Yeah.
You've got this whole range of people that your skill set has got to, your communication skills have got to be able to encompass that. And that also is fascinating that there's probably a lot of dentists who might not have that communication skill to be able to cope with that huge range. It's quite an interesting one. Yeah, it's quite interesting.
Yeah. Just rolling back just a little bit, Lovin, when you were at dental school learning the craft, when did it hit you that you might be a dentalpreneur? When did it hit you that you might end up in business? Was that quite early on, or did it something that evolved over time?
No, not really. I always knew that I wanted to be involved in a startup, in the startup space, because that excited me. Like, I had this natural excitement about it. And I found myself naturally reading, watching, learning in my own time as a hobby, anything to do with the startup world.
Dragon's Den.
Since I was young, like, and I think that that also stems from always feeling like, you know, things can be done a bit better. You know, how can we make things a little bit better for the end person, for the end impact, in this case patients? You know, I find that there are so many broken systems and processes. There are so many things that can be fixed. You can't fix everything, but there are some things that can have a bigger impact than others. And how can I contribute to that from a slice of creativity with a bit of strong values and direction and culture, and then try and build, work with great people to solve that. And I found that by practicing dentistry, I saw that there were so many inefficiencies in that system, that in the existing system 12 years ago, that largely patients could easily solve so many problems for patients. But I felt like it wasn't, because we just fall into this system and we accept the status quo and we carry on, right? We carry on. Now more than ever, people are disrupting the status quo because they realize that this isn't quite good enough for what I would expect for my patient, right? And how do we improve? How do we continuously improve? And I see so many people now, like, their dental practices are so beautiful. You know, the levels, the standards, the technology. It's like, they don't have to invest in this stuff. You can run a good dental practice on quite a basic level, right? If you wanted to, if you cared about the numbers, and that's all that mattered. But if you look at the dentists right now and what they're doing to their practices, what technology they're embedding, what they're investing in from their own back pocket, right? Their own potential income, how they're reinvesting. Like, that to me just proves that people care. These guys, it's not just a business. It's a passion for a lot of these people. And the reinvestment levels are incredible. Like, you know, you don't need to spend 40 grand on iTero. You don't need to. Right? But they are, and not just one, two, three, right? And I love it. I love seeing it. And we are in that environment now where actually people want to do the best for their patients and also really be proud of the work they do and enjoy it. And I think I felt that 12 years ago, and this was my take on how to improve that journey.
And would you say, Lovin, that you've seen a change from post-COVID, because that's where we sort of see that almost dentistry has suddenly become, it's almost like people have ignored it for the last 100 years, and then suddenly patients are going, oh, here's dentistry, actually, that's pretty cool, dentistry, I don't mind, you know. It's amazing, that transformation. You know, you mentioned the iTero, you know, dental monitoring, or all those systems that people are embracing to give their customer, their patient experience a better experience. So have you sort of seen, as at the coalface, you know, post-COVID, a difference?
100%. I think in two ways. I think everybody had a chance to reflect. Dentists had a chance to reflect to understand what type of dentistry and how they want to perform in the future, to find meaningful purpose in their work. And I feel patients also had a chance to reflect and possibly reconsider their health as at the forefront of actually what's important. You always step back, and sometimes when you're not in the thick of it day to day, 9 to 5 or whatever the hours are, and you have time to reflect. I always feel this when I go on holiday, and on the flight back, I'm always like, oh, you know what? I'm going to relook at my morning routine. You know, I'm going to tweak it a little bit, you know, and like all of those books, like Atomic Habits, start creeping back in, and all of these things that, you know, you want to refine. And I think COVID, you know, for so many months, is not just like a little holiday and the flight back. I think it gave everyone a chance to relook and reposition. And I think a lot of that investment as well from dentists is also the connection between patients wanting more and dentists wanting to do the best. And I think there's an amazing synergy between the two.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we get to chairside, you worked as an associate in the practice you're at for 10 years. So you actually joined straight from dental school, did your foundation year, then an associate for 10 years. Talk us through, so you're now a partner in the practice. Talk us through that, because quite often for lots of people, they move on to another practice to buy. You know, it's reasonably unusual for somebody to spend the amount of time you did as an associate and then buy in. How did that transition go for you and within the practice?
And who mentioned it?
Did you ask, or did
he say, or she say?
How did the transition go? I guess there were multiple factors, like anything in life. I think I started at that practice when the prince, one of the senior partner who founded the practice 30 years ago, was hitting sort of 62. But I had a really great relationship with him, and I have so much respect for that guy, Phil Wilshire. He taught me so much. He taught me all these things about loving, you know, what life's about, experiences, not about this, not about, and there's so many life lessons. He'd been through the journey where he'd owned nursing homes and he rode the highs, and then he hit the lows hard as well during that journey. And I learned so much wisdom from him. And I almost felt like he was like a mentor in many ways as a human being, for his ability to really distill down what business means in life, if that makes sense. When you're young and you're energetic and you want to do a million things, what really matters when you're 62, when it's all when you're coming to the close of it, was it really worth it? You know, are you going to look back and say, I wish I did this, wish I did that? So he kind of helped me stay very grounded, and he gave me that opportunity. And then I think going off on that, like, I was very fortunate, like my father, he going back to that story as well, he went on to then have a quite a successful career at Johnson & Johnson. He became the director of training for EMEA for sort of Johnson & Johnson eye care. And what he did was he developed a really interesting business development coaching platform, where he was providing consultancy on that level. So he started coaching me at that point on business development. Right. So, hey, Lovin, you're a dentist. You know nothing about biz dev. Let me coach you on how to, like, on management structures. Right. And I thought, oh, amazing. Okay, great. This in tune with Phil retiring, he said to me 5 years before he retired, said, Lovin, I'm on my way out soon from dentistry. What do you think? Are you up for it? And then that's how. So I spent 5 years being trained. Again, I think life is like circumstance and opportunity, and whether you're, it's up to you to grasp hold of those opportunities. But I tried to be a sponge and sit and listen to my dad, who was able to give me that advice in the transition period between Phil retiring. But that advice was also really helpful for spinning off into the entrepreneurial world with the startup as well. So I think
you said yes to it. A lot of people would have heard the opportunity and for different reasons would have passed on it. Ignored it, whatever. So, and the fact you had that kind of almost that real world MBA working along in the background, preparing you for getting into business ownership was good.
Yeah. I was very lucky. I was very lucky to be there, right time, right place, with somebody who I had a great relationship with someone who felt like I could continue his legacy as well. But giving me 5 years as a transition point to save up the money to buy a practice, and also support that journey, which he did.
I mean, when you think about it, we hear quite a lot of stories of whereby the sort of the principal has said the same thing, and then basically when they've come to the time they want to go, they just haven't followed through. So you end up with guys who sort of said, yeah, don't worry, oh, actually I can get a better value on the open market. And it's lovely to hear that there was that trust from him and trust from you.
Exactly.
Actually, yeah, I'm going to follow through with it.
Yeah. I mean, I was a guy who had no clue. Why would he give it to me? I was like a dentist, like post FD, 2 years in, with ambitious ideas. But he trusted me. And he gave me the time to nurture my skills and not just jumping in the deep end. And when the time was right for him, he transitioned out, and he still supported me after that as well throughout the whole process. And he still does to this day. So having great mentors is so essential to wanting to do anything that's beyond. Let's face it, we don't get trained on how to run a dental practice, right?
No.
We just about get trained on how to do a root canal at uni, right? Yeah. And it's a different skill set. It's a different mindset. And on my journey, what I'm seeing more and more, and I love this, is I'm seeing more and more female dental practice owners. during this journey too, because maybe as a male, you know, I naturally, in during that time, I was sort of like seeing my male mentors running businesses, right? And so naturally, I've been veering towards them for advice and stuff like that. But to actually, as a female, break the mold, considering 70% of dentistry is like female. And I'm seeing, like, through chairside, I'm talking to female practice owners. I love it. It's incredible. It's like, why not? Like, the playing field needs to be leveled. And it's great to see. Whether you're male or female, it doesn't matter. If you want to own a practice, own a practice. But females, you know, there's such a large population, and representation of practice owners is not quite balanced. And I see that changing.
That's the thing. I think it's about representation, isn't it? You know, when you look at the number of dentists we have in the country and the split between sexes, that's not represented in practice ownership. And hopefully, you know, as years roll on, that will change.
Well, only if they want to. That's the other thing. Practice ownership is not for everyone. You know, it doesn't make you more successful because you're a practice owner, right? It just means that's what you want to do, and that's the path you follow.
But I also think, for the good of the profession, I think getting inputs from different types of people in different situations and different sexes means you get a much better inflow of information, which means that's got to be good for the profession, good for patients, good for innovation
Yeah, you guys know that, like, when building a team, diversity only breeds better ideas, new perspective, new worldviews, right? The more diverse we are as an industry, as a community, as whatever it is we perceive, we share different viewpoints, and then we can innovate in new ways, with new ideas, and make the profession stronger and better. So I'm excited to see that come through, and you know, it's quite nice.
Yeah. You just loosely made reference to Chairside, which was the business you founded back in 2017, the patient communication platform. Chris and I have started a number of different businesses over the years on our sort of road to where we are now, and it's not easy. It's flipping hard work. Starting a business from scratch is not easy. It is, and the road can be bumpy, but it is hugely fulfilling. What was the spark that started what is today very well known as Chairside, and what were the bumps in the road that nearly kind of derailed you?
Really interesting question about the story and what you guys have said about it being incredibly enjoyable but incredibly hard. There is a beautiful naivety that comes when you start a business at the early doors.
So super,
where you're all excited and you're happy to take on any challenge, and I still would. But every day is a challenge, and it has its roadblocks. So this started because Kiri is my best mate. We met when we were sort of 17, 18, towards the tail end of university, tail end of school, and then we sort of lived together at uni as well. On my foundation year, I went to Sri Lanka with Kiri. We revisited because the war ended in 2009. So now this is 2010. And we contacted some dental companies, and we packed our suitcase with filling material and other dental material. And we basically went to some orphanages in the northeast of Sri Lanka, and we did some dental work there. Now, here's the big hoo-ha of like, oh yeah, we're going to do some charity work, and yeah, feel good, feel great, you know, look at how lovely we are as people. But the intent was there to do that. But actually, we probably came away with absolute gratitude and appreciation for our positions in life, and we probably took more from there than we actually gave to them. If I'll be honest with you. There's only so much someone can do once a year, going and doing dental treatment to kids who were orphans. And these orphan kids were kids who had, like, literally one of them had shrapnel still buried in their skin and had no parents, right? One of them didn't have an arm and a leg on one side of their body, because when the bombs hit, only half of their body fell into the bunker, that the other half was exposed, right? Crazy stuff. And these are like 11, 12-year-olds, right? So we're doing dental treatment, but we've never seen these kids so happy. You know, they didn't have much. They'd never known how to brush their teeth, let alone, I mean, own a toothbrush at that point, let alone actually have some of the niceties. So, but there's one thing we did do that stuck. We taught them a song with visuals on how to brush their teeth in the native language with a mix of English as well. My Tamil is terrible, by the way. Like, that's like, I get from my grandmas all the way through down. My whole family just say to me, "Lovin, you need to learn how to speak Tamil." I'm like, I don't know. Let me refine my English first. But we tried to teach these kids this song. All right, 2 years later, revisiting those orphanages, not only did the kids who were there from 2 years ago, not only could they recite this song like full motion, like the new kids who had come had learned the song. And the song was about brushing your teeth. It was literally twice a day for 2 minutes at the top, at the bottom, round and round in circles in the native language. And there was something there. I was like, speaking with Kira, is like, wow. Like, Kira was so humble. He came in, he's not a dentist, and he was literally he was our nurse, like he had his gloves on, and he had a lamp, and we had these little beds, and we were treating these kids on beds in an orphanage, and he used a torch to help me see. And he didn't really understand dentistry at the time, but then when we came back, he was like, wow. Like, we were talking, he was like, we could go and do fillings every year or two. Great. There's dentists there that can do that. But what actually resonates here is that every one of these orphanages are singing this song on how to brush their teeth. And now these kids are taking away how to brush their teeth on a daily basis, on a month. And they're doing this twice a day. And give them some toothbrushes. And like, let's talk about prevention here, right? That's one of the fundamentals that you could start with, is teaching them how to brush their teeth. And I know it's so simple, but it was the visuals and the singing that actually stuck out of everything we did. So coming back, did some research, and found out that 170 kids a day are being put to sleep under general anaesthetic in the UK to have their teeth removed because of tooth decay from something that is a largely preventable disease. 94% of the population suffer from some form of the spectrum of gum disease, with 48% chronic gum disease. And that 48% that chronic gum disease can stem into what, cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's. The links are there, right? There's a huge education piece here on preventable disease, and that resonated with me. But being a foundation dentist trainer for 6 years, I also trained foundation dentists for 6 years out of the last 12. Every year I saw them come in, they're all so scared of doing treatment. 90% of them are, according to Raj Ratan, scared of being sued, right? That's not fair on them. That's really not fair on them, because they come in with an open heart, with the right intent, but already in a fearful place to do what is already a daunting prospect of treating teeth when you come out of uni having done 10 root canals barely, right? Barely. So how do you help these kids come through and nurture them and give them the protection they need? And a lot of that litigation came from poor communication. So chairside stems from the fact that how do we make it safer and easier for dentists to communicate with patients effectively so that patients can make better decisions about their health? And that's fundamentally the vision of chairside, is to help patients make better decisions about their health through giving dentists the tools that they need to empower their patients.
Well, what a lovely start point, though, that it came about as a result of seeing how powerful patient communication was in some rural villages with orphans in Sri Lanka, and you saw the impact by informing that patient base through a creative form of communication, the impact it had,
and links brilliantly with your spoken word, doesn't it? Because obviously that's something that you've got in that creative part of your brain, that you use that to turn that into the song for brushing your teeth, and then have gone on to sort of like capitalize on it, maximize it, whatever, utilize it.
Thank you. I think for me it's a case of when you're you're always doing things that fundamentally with chairside, what Kiri and I said was, as long as the purpose is pure and the end impact is improving outcomes for patients, and we're providing solutions, we will always have a place in society, right? That's how I see it. It's just how well, how good, how, the quality of the product, how well we develop it, the execution, the ability of the execution, and that all comes down to the culture of the company and how strong the culture of our company is. Yeah. And so building culture at that point was the first thing that we wanted to do, was to create the right environment. We want to build a company that lasts the test of time. And it's really exciting to talk to you about this, because I think I might listen back to this many years down the line, because it's still the beginning of our journey. But
your legacy.
I mean, we can talk about OKRs and we can talk about ways of working and sprints and agile working and all of this, but fundamentally, you got to get the culture right, right? Kiri and I stated from the beginning, from both our journeys, because his parents are also from Sri Lanka and they've also, been refugees as a result. And we've both come from that background, and we've also seen our uncles or parents or go and start up multiple businesses here and there because they didn't have sometimes the education. The only thing they could do was build businesses, right? So we've seen how they've done it with not much in their pocket, through sheer discipline, determination, and literally it's either that or pick up an hourly job somewhere, right? Some of them did that, some of them didn't, but we learned from that. And so we're very lucky. We said, look, we want to build something. We've had a great upbringing, so many advantages and so many opportunities that we've had. Like, I'm a dentist sitting here now talking to you, when like we were in Sri Lanka treating those kids, like they had nothing, but they're probably happier than a lot of the people I know, right? Mm-hmm. Which is really weird. So like, that's why going back to that question of success, does actually success make you happy? I'm not sure. It depends on your definition of success. Mm.
It's an interesting one, isn't it, really, that sort of those journeys. I mean, it's we've done a fair few of these now, Lovin, and so what's interesting is there's a common theme of sort of an occurrence, something that has sort of almost galvanized or informed and laid down that almost DNA for how you go forward with your life.
Well, it's interesting you talk about culture. I think the principles and the foundations that set you on the path to create Chairside, it's almost like the culture wasn't in doubt, because it was built on such a strong passion for seeing the impact of improved patient communication as a result of your joint experience in Sri Lanka. You know, that is kind of just the mantra that just gets fed through everything within that business. Now, I think you're spot on. I think you get culture right at the beginning, everything else is so much easier. But you present it with your spectacles are too rosy, Lovin. There must have been some bumps on the way. It must have been some hard yards in there as well, where you
100%
it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, we pitched it to 25 investors in one go, and not a single one invested on day one. That was day one. That was off a PowerPoint presentation with no skin in the game, no proof of anything. We spun up the concept, and we had one of the guys who came on the trip with us to Sri Lanka, who ran a charity called Tamilaid. He said, he's an accountant, he owns an accounting firm, and he said, all right guys, let me get you in front of some investors to see what this looks like, right? See what, like, gauge the temperature. And we said, look guys, the future of healthcare is this, it's visual learning. 65% of patients are visual learners, yet 100% of our consults are verbal, and Chairside fills that void between visual understanding. And because we're improving communication, we solve all of these problems, XYZ, you know, patient health outcomes, litigation, even like practice performance and case acceptance. Better communication, you're gonna perform better. Goodwill as well, the whole shebang. We try and optimize communication, do the best for the patient, and everything else will come as a result. When we're seeing that, we're seeing 32% increase in case acceptance. We're seeing all of that, but you know, it's all well and good saying it to investors or saying it and putting it out there when you don't have any proof, and then trying to get them to back it. So we didn't have any. So Kiri and I, what we did was, for 2 years, whether this was the right thing or the wrong thing, we basically worked full time. And every evening and weekend, we put our own earnings into a pot that we used to build and develop the product, all the animations, all the content. We got patents secured, and we sort of did all of that. And it was a very costly exercise. I'm not sure if it was the right thing to do, but what we did was we went as far as we could on a personal liability level to de-risk the company, to make it attractive to investors. And that took time, and there was a lot of sweat in it, and there were lots of money, a lot of money wasted on things that we didn't know we were doing that was right, wrong. A lot of agencies that we wasted a lot of cash on that might not have worked. And we, yeah, but I tell you what, we may have wasted, you know, a few thousand then, but having learned those lessons, we probably save a few tens of thousands now, knowing that that was not the right thing to do. And we learned that from our way. We also understood each other's learning styles and working styles. Mm. You know, the beautiful thing about Kiri is he complements the things I'm really bad at, right? Mm. At the same time, I probably... open his mind to like a world of opportunities that he is kind of more ready to do the day-to-day, like I'm gonna aim today, and I'm like, yeah, but this is the long-term vision, so this is where we're going, and we complement each other so well. But during that time, it was almost like learning on the go. So after we'd proven a few concepts, we got our first investment from our first angel investor. And it was after that. And since then, actually, we've not had anyone, no, since the third investment round, we've not had anyone turn down investing in Chairside up until now anyway. Good. But we've had, in the first three rounds, we've had surplus of like 40 rejections. So,
and that's a really good story to tell, Lovin, because I think the danger with life being what it is, and we were talking before about kind of, you know, ego and social media. We tend to celebrate when success comes, and it's nice, I always think, for people to hear how hard it is at the beginning.
Yeah. What was it, Starbucks? Wasn't Starbucks 281 rejections or something before someone funded Starbucks? Yeah.
And it's great to hear that you are where you are now. But for anybody else, you know, thinking about embarking on a new business or a startup or whatever, you know, they need to know that it's absolutely doable, it's absolutely fulfilling, and it's going to push you to the limit. And all those things are okay.
Yeah.
All those things are okay.
And actually enjoyable.
Yeah. And the thing is, yeah, that thing you said about, you know, you kind of quickly reframed the money you wasted on agencies to what you learnt from the process. And I think that's what it is. You know, sure, that money was spent, but it meant you kept pushing on. And now you're in a much better shape as a result of that real life experience. Because somebody with more experience could have told you what it was going to be like. But that's not the reality. The reality isn't. The reality is you living and breathing and going through it yourself. Mm. That's what really matters.
Identifying and failing fast, I think, is a really important thing to learn.
Oh, that's our man.
So you get rid of it.
It's so important to fail fast, to make mistakes. But you have to learn, and you only really learn when you do things and you make mistakes. It's the same in dentistry. You know, you've got to do that composite that's slightly outside of your comfort zone in the growth phase, where to understand that, you know, maybe it didn't quite work and learn from it. I learned a lot from my mistakes. I've learned a lot from my practicing, because I've been in the same practice for 12 years. I can still look at the endos I did 12 years ago, and I can still look at the restorations I did, you know, 6 years ago, and I've been able to critically assess myself from x-rays and there's always opportunities to learn, always things to do. And if you're not constantly doing that, you're not growing really, are you? And
no,
that's quite interesting. If your technique journey in your 12 years, you know, from what you did first time round and what you do now, I bet there's probably a big difference between.
Oh, massively.
That's quite a good one, really, isn't it? You almost always got a constant reminder of like, oh, yep, okay, I could do better.
There's constant feedback. Dentistry is a prime example for that, for constant growth. The course. Dental courses right now, like, I mean, how many people spend thousands of pounds on any course, and it's a no-brainer, right? They'll go on it. That's why I love the motivation of dentists. Like, they're willing to just constantly excel, constantly improve, constantly grow. Or the ones who are the ones who will continue to push the industry, the profession forward. Yeah,
I was going to say it is a remarkable profession in that way. We were talking at the beginning, Lovin, about kind of creativity and you know, you were drawn to the profession through the craft. And there's obviously a strong and arguably increasing artistic element to dentistry for where we are now and where it's likely to be in the future. you obviously creative in a different way as well, in that you rap and you do the spoken word and stuff. Was that something you I'm interested as to whether has that influenced your dentistry, or has your dentistry influenced that, or do the two just coexist and run side by side? Is there like a point where you kind of benefit in one area or the other?
There did. I think when I was 14, I loved the whole hip-hop era. I grew up in that era. And I think also a lot of my, like, the community I was in resonated with that sort of rags to riches stories, like inspired by those hip-hop stories of when you see, because I mean, if you imagine this, like, we're kids, like, of immigrant parents, like, first generation, and we're listening to hip-hop stories of people from the streets with nothing, making something out of their lives, right? And we're like, oh, yeah. Wow, yeah, look, these guys did it. And then you start writing your own story a little bit, right, through that journey. And then you realize that actually the world's not ready maybe for loving the rapper when he was 14. But
it's true, though, isn't it? When you look at Snoop Dogg, gets paid, what, $5 million for Just Eat or something.
I mean, yeah, something like that, yeah. But I loved writing. I loved it. And actually, weirdly, at school, maybe, you know, there's some kids who are, who were looked to for their, or respected for their football skills, or some kids that were respected for their academia or whatnot, right? Or being great at rugby, or just being good looking, I don't know. But for me, I always found that it was because when it was battle rapping other schools, I would be the guy who'd represent our school.
Did you dress like a rapper?
I didn't. Well, at the time, when you're 18 or 15 or 16, you know, you try to fit in. And like I did try. That's all I'm it wasn't a good look for me, I'll be honest. I think I'm so glad smartphones weren't around then. But there's no photographic evidence. Don't ask Kiri though, he's got some. But so rapping was really cool for that, and just storytelling. And I think why I liked it was because without any ego, I tend to win some of those battles. And so it gave me this identity of loving, this is your thing. You're good at this. You're good at battle rapping. You're good at telling stories through raps. Loving, you should do something with this. If you're not, you're not fulfilling your potential, right? Mm-hmm. And that kind of maybe haunted me. It was a gift and a curse, to be honest with you. Because it was almost like at that time, Afro-Caribbean black rappers were not mainstream still from the UK. It wasn't a thing. And I love the fact that now Stormzy is who he is.
Because
you couldn't imagine that. I mean, Dizzy Rascal was the first, but he was a one-off. And for 20 years, it took all of us to grow up to be the consumer to then allow that industry to thrive, right? And now you've got loads of them, and I love that. But there was definitely not a time in society at that point where I think the world was ready for an Asian rapper. Maybe not.
Yeah,
right?
That's true, isn't it?
So just playing with this passion thing and realizing that, is there really an opportunity? It's really against all odds. Should I really pursue it? And also, by the way, you're a dentist. You know, you could have a very comfortable career, let's face it.
Have a proper job.
Being a dentist and enjoy that. Yeah, exactly. So it was a conflict of, this is my identity versus this is my profession. And there's only so many hours in life. And what do you want to hone your craft on, and what do you want to be great at? And that then became dentistry. And arguably,
but there's nothing like a little itch, is there, that you can't keep, you can't stop scratching
with a side order of rapping.
A side order, that is the itch that I decided to scratch in June when I decided to do some spoken word. And this was stuff I've been writing for the past 10 years. And interestingly, whether it was timing or not, but society's come to a place where the stuff I rap about is actually become relevant now. Whereas when I was writing, doing the song, the spoken word stuff that I do now, I don't think would have resonated 10 years ago, if I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I think sometimes timing's right. It's interesting what you say about, you know, the very strong Afro-Caribbean heritage in rapping, and you saying, you know, the world probably wasn't ready for an Asian rapper. And it just, saying that today just seems mad that, you know, we live in London, so it's incredibly diverse and multicultural. But it's funny how you sometimes just need the timing to be right for certain things to land.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you take, for example, the singing dentist, Milad, right? Exceptionally talented. And he actually was in the scene. When So Solid were doing their thing, he was in the scene. Yeah. And I think timing has worked really well for him now, because you can clearly see he's a very talented rapper, right? Yes. And he's found his position now. But like, he could have easily been that guy then if society was open to it too, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it's actually just really nice to see people doing their thing, representing themselves, and the passion that they've got for it. And, you know, you have it from childhood. You can't let go. Mm.
But also, things can change quickly. I was very fortunate to be at Glastonbury in 2019 when Stormzy headlined.
All right.
He said, I don't think even 2 years ago this could have happened. And it's amazing how, you know, as a grime artist to headline on the Pyramid stage, you know, the biggest stage at Glastonbury, nearly 250,000 people there. You know, just a few years earlier, that wouldn't have even been considered on the calendar. So things can flick. There quite often there's a tipping point, isn't there, where things just kind of turn.
There is. And I think right now there is a tipping point in dentistry post-COVID. And I think dental practices are really... and patients are really interested in their dental health, whether it be cosmetics, whether it be orthodontics. And I think dental practices are gearing up really nicely, or at least the early adopters to that world are gearing up for it. And I'm excited for the industry moving forward, because one thing I've been very fortunate to do is study the strategy and the almost the mechanics of how ideas spread, whether it be grime and Stormzy. When Dizzy Rascal and Wiley were the originals, right? And if you look at the originals and then the ones who actually commercially make it 20 years later, and if you look at how ideas spread, like electric cars or the iPad, and that's the same with chairside.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. It's like it will become mainstream. I have no doubt about that. It's just at that point where the early adopters are excited by it and pioneering it. And there is a certain personality type that comes after that tipping point that's willing to accept the new status quo. And the infrastructure has to be in place for it too. So we're gearing up for that.
Yeah, but brilliant. Also hugely exciting for you. Yeah. We always ask our guests the same two questions at the end, but before we get to that, we've got one more question which links back to the music. You got played on BBC Radio 1.
Yeah.
What's the story around that?
So when I was actually doing less spoken word and more rap, it was in my fourth year of uni. I met up with this producer. His name's Charles Bosco, and he's incredibly talented. Again, from a similar background. And I also have this friend called Arjun, who's again incredibly talented. And at that moment in time, there was something happening in the Asian music industry, right? So I would make English raps. Yeah, I would go to BBC One Extra and they'd say to me, it's not quite grimy enough. But then I'd go to the BBC Asia Network and they say, it's not quite bunga enough. And I was like, oh man, like, I just want to rap, right? I just want to tell stories. But the music is so relevant to which radio station this plays. So Charles Bosco is a master of mixing ethnic samples with Western beats, and there was a big dubstep era at that time, right? So he spun up, so we sat down and we're like, that sample sounds amazing, here's what dubstep sounds like, let's mix it. And we rapped over it, and we sent it out to radio, right? And got played on BBC Asia Network first of all, and we were number one on the Asia Network charts for a month on that track. That then crossed over to BBC Radio 1. And so we got played on BBC Radio 1 for about 8 weeks. And then three other tracks after that got played on BBC Radio 1 for 8 weeks. So then this is when I'm thinking, I'm in my fourth year of uni, I'm graduating in fifth year. I'm thinking, wow, I'm finally on Radio 1. Is there anything, you know, what can come of this? But, you know, a lot of those songs were, again, played evening specialist radio stations at 7 p.m. onwards, sort of thing, which was great, which is fine, because it was never going to hit the playlist, and you know, it was never going to be 10 a.m. in the morning, but it was still 7 p.m., 8 p.m. You know, those tracks were being played, and it was just a nice moment to connect, I guess, with a moment in the dubstep era with my own identity of ethnic samples, working with great people like Charles and Arj, and then putting my own storytelling over it. But again, timing, right?
Yeah, and also you don't know, you know, what impact would that have had on, you know, other young people similar to yourself that would have listened to that back in that era. It was like a lollipop moment where they thought, well, hold on a minute, I've not heard this before. And I did that give somebody the inspiration, you know, the nudge they needed to go and then do their thing. There wasn't a roadmap for before. So, that's fabulous.
You're spot on. Find you on Spotify.
I haven't actually got anything on Spotify. It's like all my stuff.
Well, there's an opening there then. It must be.
I'll
be your manager.
So Lovin, we always finish up in the same way. We always ask our guests the same two questions. And the first one we have for you is, if you could be a fly on the wall in a situation, when and where would you be and who would you be with?
Really, I thought about this because it came through in the email, the question, and I was like, okay, there's actually just one moment that I'd really love to be a fly on the wall for. Was when, do you remember when Eric Cantona did that kung fu kick?
Crystal Palace.
Jumped into the crowd, didn't he?
Okay, so here's my issue. Sir Alex Ferguson, he let go. I admire this guy so much, right? He let go of Roy Keane, his captain, right? Because he thought he was too big. He was bigger than the team, right? He let go David Beckham for a similar reason. He let go of so many people because there's no one player. And with the Cristiano situation right now, you wonder how Alex Ferguson would deal with this. It probably wouldn't have got to this point, to be honest with you, if Sir Alex was there. But hey, but how does Eric Cantona throw a flying kick and still? I would just love to be there for that conversation, because what my understanding is was from what Brian Robson said in one of his, Brian Robson said in one of his podcasts, I think, or in an interview, was like, typically when United lose, he'd say to the boys, he'd say, all right, lads, just do an extra lap after the game. You know, the gaff is he's a bit heated right now. Let's just spend some time out here before we go back into the dressing room. But when Eric Cantona did that flying kick, he was like, all right, boys, let's get into the dressing room right now. This is going to be class. Because the viewpoint here was that how he treated Eric Cantona in a very different way because of Eric Cantona's personality. He's a very passionate guy. He loved football. And he was actually a Ronaldo of his time almost. He was like a very special player. Yeah. He couldn't give him the hairdryer treatment, right?
No.
So I wonder how he managed that situation.
I think that was his superpower. I think his ability to manage, he didn't manage a team. He managed individual people, and he knew what levers to pull, buttons to push to get the best out of people. Mm. And for whatever reason, he felt that you know, he managed Cantona in a particular way. Mm. That will be a great one to watch.
I'm so intrigued to see what he said to him. How did he manage him without... Because Cantona would have been very passionate about that and very adamant that was the right thing to do. Yeah. But obviously, it's not the right thing to do, right? Mm. How do you do that without forcing the player out and disagreeing with them, but also disciplining them to know that that's not acceptable, right? When someone is purely emotional about the sport.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. No, yeah. Very good one. That will be great to watch on. And our follow-up question is, if you could meet somebody, who would you like to meet if you were given the opportunity?
Living or dead, real or fictional?
Real or fiction. Interesting. Do you know, I know this is a bit off-piste, but someone I really respect before her creativity is J.K. Rowling. Mm-hmm. How do you create that world, that Harry Potter world that has become an absolute franchise and like phenomenon, from down to like the names of the characters and its relevance to society and how she's drawn from history and drawn from historic wars and British history and then like split from bad and evil, from evil and good, and created this magical world that has captured kids around the world, not just during that era, but even still today. I find fascinating. And for me, that is almost the epitome of creativity, right?
Well, isn't it, didn't she also plan them? Didn't she also work out there were going to be, I think it's 7 books, isn't it? I don't really do Harry Potter. But I think she worked out the plan before she started writing.
So she knew it was going to be successful.
Which, I mean, it's flipping amazing, isn't it?
And she got rejected.
To finish them at the right point for the next story to follow.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Everything was almost executed to perfection. And she was, similar story, you know, single mother, I believe, like rejected, writing in little flats, writing stories in little flats, not getting a book deal. Only eventually it's the same story, isn't it? You get rejected, and then something happens.
Builds resilience.
It doesn't surprise me, Lovin, that you went for somebody highly creative, given your own path, the things you've done. It doesn't surprise that you're fascinated by somebody who's got huge creativity in their own soul. Lovin, it's been an absolute joy. It's been such an enjoyable and pleasant conversation. I think the stuff you're doing is great. I think people will take a lot from, you know, the work that goes into setting up something new. And I think you've got so much more to come. I think there's lots of chapters of your story yet to be written.
There's lots of lessons in that podcast, isn't
absolutely
there?
Absolutely.
Well, no, I really
appreciate your time today, Lovin. Hopefully we'll be catching up soon.
Thank you, guys. Cheers, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.